are listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
During his long career as a prosecutor and as attorney general, and before he resigned as governor, Elliot Spitzer often targeted the alleged misdeeds of financial institutions. It won him few friends on Wall Street, leading the media to dub him the Sheriff of Wall Street. Since leaving the governor's office, he has reemerged as a Slate.com columnist and as an outspoken critic of the financial industry, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hello.
Welcome, and thank you for having me.
I know that hindsight is 20/20, but in surveying the wreckage of the financial crisis, do you think that this was something that could have been prevented?
Oh, sure. And I think we don't point out often enough that we basically went for 50 years between the inception of the New Deal and the mid-1980s, let's say, without a financial crisis. In other words, there was a very lengthy period of time when a regulatory structure was in place that prevented the crashes and the bubbles that we have lived through sequentially over the last decade.
But we did have recessions. We had
recessions, yes, and business cycles, absolutely. But the magnitude of those was less than what we have suffered through. And there was an architecture in place that maintained the stability of the financial system. And so the bubbles and the recessions were separate and apart and were exogenously driven, oil-driven, for instance, but very different in feel from what we've just gone through.
Last month, the congressionally appointed Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission began looking into the causes of the 2008 crash. Has anything about the hearing surprised you so far?
Well, Phil Angelides is the chair of that commission, a very good individual who was the treasurer in California before he took that position. I guess there are some years in between. It is a bipartisan commission, which is good, but problematic in the sense that Phil has had trouble getting subpoena power. He needs sign off from folks from both parties to get subpoenas issued. They will not succeed unless they issue subpoenas to the relevant agencies and companies that really dig into the guts of what happened. And so far, they haven't been able to do that.
In an interview with the Wall Street Journal, Phil Angelides said the committee was using its subpoena power to look at 10 to 12 specific practices at specific institutions. Given your experience with investigations, do you think that's too narrow or too broad a scope?
Well, until we know specifically what he's looking at, we don't know. But I would suggest this, and in fact, I had an op-ed with some other folks suggesting that AIG release all of its emails. Now, why did I suggest that? We as taxpayers own AIG. AIG was at the vortex. It was the black box. It was the center of the web. And if we were to actually parse the AIG transactions and understand the dynamic between AIG and the Fed, AIG and Goldman, AIG and all the other counterparties, at so many levels, we could then begin to get a greater texture on what led to the debacle that we're now, the wreckage that we're now trying to clean up. And I think I analogized it to an open source investigation. Let everybody see this material and poke at it.
Well, in an interview last month with the Wall Street Journal, the former CEO of AIG, Hank Greenberg, placed the blame for the collapse of his company on the machinations of Goldman Sachs.
Right. Well,
and everybody seems to be pointing a finger at Goldman Sachs.
It's easy to point the finger at the person who has the money at the moment. And I've certainly had taken my shots at Goldman Sachs for certain of aspects of their behavior and certain benefits they've been given, which in my mind were not appropriate given some of their other behavior and certainly were not matched with other demands of them in terms of changes in behavior. That's something we can talk about perhaps. But Hank Greenberg does want to rewrite history more than a little bit. He was, of course, the long-standing and very powerful and effective CEO of AIG, but left under circumstances where there were very significant accounting frauds.
You went after him when you were Attorney
yes.
General.
Well, I phrase it differently. We went after the fraud. We didn't really target him as an individual. The fraud and the company settled it and paid a fine of $1.4 billion. And it was something that was really fundamental to the way they were running their books. And then people went to jail for this. He was called an unindicted co-conspirator. So he is not blameless. And I think that's an important point to make for the historical record.
And those kinds of investigations didn't earn you many friends on Wall Street. You were the state's top legal officer. You were going after national and international financial companies, but you were going after companies that were important to New York State's economy, weren't you?
Absolutely. And it caused political ripples, political problems. It did not, as you pointed out, win me friends on Wall Street, but I felt You know, not to sound sacrosanct about it, but that was the job. I mean, the issue wasn't go after only those financial companies that are not important or do not generate tax revenue for New York. What we were also trying to do was make the larger statement that there were structural problems that needed to be confronted.
Last month, the FCIC took testimony from the heads of Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America. And at the beginning of the hearings, Chairman Angelides homed in on Goldman Sachs, especially their alleged practice of hawking mortgage-backed securities and then betting against them. Is that where you would start if you were heading the commission?
Well, not really. I think that was a good rhetorical moment, and I think that that's what Phil wanted. There is a tension there. There's a conflict there inherent in Goldman doing proprietary trading, which may be at odds with what it's recommending to its customers, and that's a very significant issue that needs to be worked through structurally for these banks. But I think in terms of understanding the root causes, I think we need to look deeper into the relationship between Goldman, the issuance of the debt, and what they and the rating agencies and the originators of the debt understood about how reliable this debt was and the leverage that was built into all of this.
Well, you said it was a rhetorical moment. Some people would call it political theater, which is something your supporters and opponents also would say you used to great effect at times.
Well, sure.
And is there an investigative value to political theater?
Yes, and there is a value to congressional hearings, which is what this in essence is, to galvanize and explain to the public and crystallize a public understanding, which is part and parcel of generating the support for reform. Now, it's a different thing as a prosecutor. We didn't have hearings. We would bring cases, and people often attacked the cases, and I understood they would do so, and that's certainly their right to do so, and I don't quibble with their doing it. I disagree with them in terms of their characterization of our cases, which were successful and we proved our facts, but I think there is a utility to having hearings which permit the public to understand an issue in a context that might not have existed before the hearing.
My guest is Elliot Spitzer, and we are talking about the current financial crisis and how it is being dealt with. The commission is supposed to produce a report by the end of the year, but the Obama administration is pushing for more regulations on the financial industry now. Is the federal government getting ahead of itself, or should it enact more legislation as soon as possible?
Well, I think that let me step back. The best analogy to the Angelides Commission is the Pecora Commission back in the 30s, after the Depression and the market crash of 29. The critical difference, of course, is that in 1929 and in the period thereafter, the stock market really was a black box. Virtually nothing was understood until the inquiries of the Pecora Commission. We know a great deal more today about what happened than they did back then. So I think the administration can move forward and should move forward with great speed to put in place the structural, architectural changes that we need. My problem with many of their proposals, frankly, is that they do not, I think, get to the nub of the problem.
A couple of weeks ago, we had Joseph Stiglitz on the show, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, and he said that the root of this problem occurred when Paul Volcker was replaced by Alan Greenspan, and we moved away from that whole sense of things being regulated tightly.
Correct.
Now Paul Volcker is back in the news as somebody who's promoting a return to regulation.
Right.
One of the key factors was the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act. Could we just reinstate it?
Not really. The world has changed too much to simply bring back Glass-Steagall, reimpose it upon the current financial system, and solve the problems. First, Joe Stiglitz is brilliant, and kind of doesn't need to be said. He won the Nobel Prize. I think that speaks for itself. His critique is exactly right. During the period up through and including Paul Volcker's tenure at the Fed, there was a sense that banks as institutions needed to be regulated in terms of leverage, risk, size. Too big to fail was not an issue then because the Fed kept them from becoming too big. We then went into this deregulatory spasm. And Alan Greenspan is perhaps the economic equivalent to President Reagan, who was the political voice for it. And we permitted these financial institutions to grow to gargantuan size, take on unimaginable risk. And then the collapse was, not surprising, a very painful one.
You became Attorney General in 1998 at a time of increased liberalization of the markets a year before the Glass-Steagall Act was repealed by Congress in 1999. Do you feel that you were moving against an ideological tide at the time?
Oh, absolutely. There was no question that I was an outlier ideologically. This was the period of deregulation, or as they called it, self-regulation. The markets would regulate themselves. Businesses would not act in a way that was improper or would create excessive risk, a notion that I rejected from the very beginning because I think it reflected a misunderstanding of market behavior. And as I always said to the thoughtful people on the other side who were proponents of deregulation, I said, you don't understand how markets really function. You need the check of government, and economists will make that very clear. Unfortunately, I think we've learned that lesson the hard way now.
Wasn't that also before the collapse of Enron?
Yes. This is long before Enron, long before the other bubbles that we have seen along the way that were really the premonition of what was going to happen later on.
Well, they were talking about the economy working in a rational way.
Correct.
Didn't things like Enron suggest that maybe it wasn't all that rational?
One would have hoped so. But again, economists during that period loved to talk about the rational economic actor. And Judge Posner, who was one of the great voices of this, Richard Posner of the Seventh Circuit and the University of Chicago, wrote long and very powerful books saying it would be irrational to act in any other way. Interestingly, he is one of great intellectual integrity. He has switched. He's now come around to the other side and said, hey, you know what? Markets failed. We need regulation. And I think that is now, I hope that is now where most people come out.
Yesterday, Paul Volcker testified before the Senate Banking Committee about the administration's proposed regulations, including one that would ban banks from proprietary trading, another prohibiting them from owning hedge funds and private equity funds. Right. There are also caps on the size of financial institutions. What's your take on those proposals?
Certainly a powerful and important step forward, and I think it is important to understand the political significance of this as well, in the sense that President Obama has, for the first year, relied primarily, if not exclusively, upon Larry Summers and Tim Geithner, who came from what I think it's fair to call the President Bush worldview of Wall Street regulation. They might bridle at that, but I think it's a fair statement.
Well, so didn't he send a signal when he appointed them rather than other people who might have had a different take?
Absolutely. I would have preferred that we have either a Joe Stiglitz or a Paul Krugman or a Paul Volcker. Now, there really were two camps. There were those who said we should have learned a lesson, not that Stiglitz and Krugman needed to learn it, that they have been articulating this for a long time. They have long been proponents of reestablishing sound practices, regulatory structures to limit risk. Geithner and Summers were part of the deregulatory phenomenon.
And some people didn't want to see Ben Bernanke reappointed as chairman
Correct.
Of the Fed because of this.
And neither nor did I. I mean, I think, again, none of this goes to the integrity of these individuals. Ben Bernanke is a spectacular scholar and wonderful individual, but he had embraced an ideological perspective that simply led us astray.
Last September, you wrote in your Slate.com column that the scope of authority now claimed and sought by the Fed makes these confirmation hearings more important than any I can recall. Do you feel your concerns about Bernanke and the Fed have been adequately addressed since?
Well, no, but one hopes springs eternal, and perhaps, and I'm sure he has learned a great deal. We all have. So I think the way I view it is a couple points I would make. One, they always had the power they needed to reimpose a regulatory framework on the market. They chose not to use it. So they don't really need to go back to Congress for more power. They had loads of power. But I think the question is, will Ben Bernanke, having lived through this, now revert to a more Stiglitzian or Krugman or Paul Volcker worldview, understanding what structures he needs to put in place? I certainly hope so.
Were you surprised? Because he is a scholar of the Depression, something that we were reminded of again and again as things were falling apart.
I was surprised because he seemed to understand, obviously did understand, the critical need for government intervention in terms of liquidity and solvency of the banks, but did not seem to grasp the other piece of it, which is that in return for providing this unending stream of capital to the banks, the banks should then be obligated to act within certain parameters, limit their risk, and do certain things that would actually help the economy. That disconnect is what bothered me.
We will continue this conversation about the economy with Elliot Spitzer after a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Elliot Spitzer talking about the economy. Yesterday, Senate Banking Committee Chairman Chris Dodd said that the administration was getting precariously close to excessive ambition for its legislation. Could the administration be trying to get too much out of a Congress that doesn't seem to be willing to do pretty much anything?
Well, I didn't know how to interpret Senator Dodd's comment. Was he saying he disagreed with it intellectually, or he felt politically he couldn't move at all? I think there's no question that when the president announced the Volcker Rule, as we now call it, he was making an important and critically necessary step forward. So I was a little distressed to see that Senator Dodd was saying we have things on track, because the sense we get from listening to the murmurings coming out of Capitol Hill is that the bill that will get the bipartisan support that Senator Dodd was talking about won't do very much, and that would be a disappointment.
There have been reports that the proposed Consumer Financial Protection Agency may also be dead on arrival in the Senate. Would you consider that a setback for reform efforts?
A big setback. And again, let me distinguish. It's not that there isn't enough power within the FDIC or OTS or the OCC or the Fed to impose good consumer protections. It's that nobody has ever done it. And if you create a separate entity and put an Elizabeth Warren in charge, then it will happen. And that, Elizabeth Warren, I think, is one of the few heroines to emerge from this entire debacle.
What would you say is the most important regulation needed for the financial industry right now?
Confront the issue of too big to fail. The notion of institutions that are so big that they know that they have now an explicit guarantee of federal backing, which then permits them to invest in a way that takes on more risk than is appropriate, which creates what we call this asymmetry, socialization of risk, privatization of gain. That imbalance is dangerous.
Well, one of the complaints is that the Securities and Exchange Commission was pretty much toothless during the period when all of these things were developing.
Yes, it was toothless by design. It was when Harvey Pitt was nominated and then became the chair of the SEC under President Bush, he gave a speech to the financial services industry where he said, you will now see a kinder, gentler SEC. In other words, this was very much an accommodation to industry.
Well,
that was the problem.
The SEC had been warned that Bernard Madoff was running a Ponzi scheme, and yet it failed to uncover what he was doing. That goes beyond just being kind to the financial institutions.
Okay. There will always be lapses in incompetence in any organization that size. I think the Madoff story is a uniquely stark and horrifying story, because that Ponzi scheme could have and would have been uncovered with the most simple of questioning.
Well, there were reports that your family's real estate business had invested with Bernie Madoff. How does your family business come to be involved?
Only in a very indirect way. In other words, through somebody else with whom we had invested. So I had never heard his name, knew of him, et cetera. So.
And you never heard his name when you were Attorney General? Nobody came
No,
to
remarkably.
You?
And boy, as you can imagine, I look back now and wish we had. Because as I said, any investigator could have gone to him and said, show me one day of trading records. Who is the custodian who actually holds the shares? Let me line up and see if you actually have taken possession. And the whole thing would have collapsed. And so it's kind of hard to fathom how this happened.
A number of people talk about not knowing that their money was going to Bernard Madoff. But is that part of the problem? Shouldn't
yes.
We keep on talking about transparency.
Absolutely.
I'm not sure what transparency means in situations like that.
There is a culture of trust and a hesitancy to ask the right questions. And this is what is required in meaningful due diligence. And I think people are now beginning to take all of this much more seriously, as of course they should. I mean, the horror stories are legion. You must ask hard questions.
Well, there's another kind of cultural issue that we've been discussing a lot on this program. The cultural problems, perceived ones on Wall Street, from a willingness to take on too much risk to a focus on short-term profits over long-term stability. Do you think there really is any way that those kinds of attitudes are going to be changed?
Yes, I'm an optimist at sort of a macro level. I think some people point to the transformation of the Wall Street trading houses from partnerships to publicly traded corporations as being the mechanism that led to this shift to the shorter-term focus. Whether that is it or not, I don't know with certainty. But I think, yes, there is a way to both create an incentive structure that focuses on the long term, a regulatory structure that clamps down on some of the more outrageous short-term games that were being played, and a rejuvenation of entities such as the rating agencies that are so central to weighing and understanding risk.
Well, I've been hearing reports that credit card offers are on the rise again, and that was one of the indicators in that led to this problem.
Right. There will always be problems. I think the book I recommend is Galbraith's A Short History of Financial Euphoria, a brilliant little volume written after the 87 stock market drop. That is, when you read it, you would believe that it had been written a month ago. It is such a clear articulation of what happened in this cycle.
Our listeners have been writing in questions. Maybe I should address a few of them before I continue. A caller wants to know your position on the recent Supreme Court ruling, Citizens United versus the FEC.
I have a position on that is perhaps a little jarring to some people, and here's why. I am as concerned as everybody is and should be about the money that will flow into politics. But the technical issue, and not so technical, is that corporate free speech covers the New York Times editorial page, Rachel Maddow, Bill O'Reilly, in the same way that it covers the movie that was at issue in that case. And until people can distinguish for me how we could limit the free speech that attended to one without impacting the other, there's a piece of me that thinks maybe the Supreme Court was right in saying, look, this is what free speech is about.
But the Supreme Court is also based on precedent. And yes, in making such a broad decision, they just threw out 100 years of precedent,
well,
didn't they?
They overrode some precedents. I will say precedent is used sparingly when you want to. Look, Brown versus Board of Ed, one of the greatest decisions in our history, also overthrew precedent. So precedent shouldn't override good judgment.
Yeah, but Rachel Maddow isn't General Electric. We're talking about somebody who can say something on a TV show that has a limited number of viewers, as opposed to corporations that can spend millions of dollars to sway us. We've seen similar things in the past. The last time healthcare reform was proposed, a campaign really destroyed
Absolutely.
Any possibility of that going through.
But on the other hand, in a way, Rachel Maddow is corporate speech because it is GE does own MSNBC, and so soon will be Comcast, I suppose. And so the issue we need to parse is how can we make sure we protect that speech and differentiate properly among these different, if we can, among these different voices.
My guest is Elliot Spitzer. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Some might say that our current Attorney General, Andrew Cuomo, has modeled his style on the way that you handled the post. Do you think that's the case?
I think he has continued the priorities in terms of examining issues that are of import to the economy at large, whether it be Wall Street, the environment, et cetera. So I think to that extent, he has probably continued some of what we tried to do.
Many political observers are waiting for him to announce whether he'll run for governor against your former lieutenant governor. Do you think that he should?
I don't think it's my place to give political advice in terms of saying whether somebody should or shouldn't. I would merely observe that being a governor these days is a very difficult position. And I don't say that to apologize or to mask errors that have been made by anybody. But if you look at John Corzine, whom very talented, good, smart individual, did not get reelected in New Jersey, Ted Strickland in Ohio, DeVal Patrick having a rough go in Massachusetts, or Arnold Schwarzenegger, a brilliant politician, everyone who sits in that chair with revenues that are down 20% and an imperative to fund education and healthcare and infrastructure is finding it very difficult to maintain political footing.
Part of the reason New York State is going through economic difficulties is that a large part of our income comes from taxes on Wall Street.
Right.
Do you see that source of revenue returning anytime soon? And if we apply new regulations, will we be able to return to the kind of situation we had in the past?
Well, a couple observations. One, let's certainly hope that, that prosperity returns at every level in every sector. Yes, Wall Street had an outsized impact on the revenue for the state, and the Wall Street bonuses in particular had a nice caused a nice jump for state tax revenues. That being said, with the fundamental change in the financial services sector, I don't think the state can look forward to getting that much in the future from the financial services sector, nor should it.
Well, the Obama administration is proposing a so-called bailout tax on firms valued over $50 billion that receive government assistance. That could possibly raise up to $117 billion over 12 years. New York State could do something similar, couldn't it?
Well, we could. I think we have to be careful in how we tax and what we do. Let's get the I believe in fundamentally transforming the industry. I think then it will generate the revenues we need. I think New York State needs to diversify its economy, biotech, nanotech, other areas that, that we should be in the leadership position to generate jobs in the
future.
And
we don't seem to be doing that upstate. Upstate, which used to be a thriving manufacturing area, now seems to be in dire economic straits.
Upstate has gone through a difficult transformation. The model that I was embracing was to basically make the educational institutions across upstate, and we have a remarkable web of both public and private higher educational institutions, make them intellectual incubators for the intellectual capital that would then drive job creation. I think Ithaca with Cornell and Ithaca College are a prime example of that. It can work, but it requires investment and long-term thinking. You look at NYU, Columbia, other colleges here in the city, providing that function and that magnet for the intellectual capital that we need.
The New York legislature recently passed an ethics bill, which Governor Patterson vetoed yesterday. Would you have vetoed it?
I have not looked at the precise details. I think so. I think it was not sufficient. And I think in terms of the disclosure, the transparency of revenue sources that that legislators had, it did not go nearly far enough.
Some people argue that any ethics bill is better than none. And this is something that a governor or president has to consider. We're going to talk about a health care reform. Is any health care reform better than nothing?
Not letting the perfect be the enemy of the good is, of course, an old saying. And when you sit there, do I sign? Do I negotiate? Where do I draw the line? Is the balance that one strikes all the time or tries to strike. It's very hard to know where to say, yes, this is sufficient. I think in the ethics bill, David did the right thing, saying to the legislature, go back, do something more, do something better.
His party controls both houses of the state legislature, and yet he can't seem to get anything through.
Kind of. And the reason I say kind of is that the Senate is in a very odd position of almost equal pose with such a tenuous control in the terms of the Democratic Party. Look, I'll be very clear. When I was governor, I tried very hard to get meaningful Democratic control, not out of a partisan desire to control, but because I thought that only then could we get the real reform, whether it was Rockefeller drug reform or same-sex marriage or the environmental or the educational changes that we needed. We're not quite there, and hopefully that will happen.
Well, talking about ethics reform, a listener has written in to insist that I bring up the issue of the loan that you had taken out to pay for your unsuccessful bid for Attorney General in 1994.
That was an absolutely proper structure and loan that not only did I pay back, of course, but it was a family loan that was absolutely proper.
So you're saying that there's nothing that you have to
apologize
for? And that's for
no. Look, I just so it's clear, I'm not, as the world now knows, I'm not spotless, and I don't pretend to be that. That is not the, from the questioner's point of view, I would say that is not an issue that really is worthy of conversation. Others have been, and hence I'm sitting where I am and state the obvious.
Which we're not going to address because it's already been talked about to the point of absurdum.
Well, thank you.
In a statement released about the vetoed ethics bill, the governor also said, "We must bring fundamental change to the culture of Planet Albany." What do you make of calling Albany your planet?
I understand his sentiments and the frustration he feels that there is a sense that the legislature has not had the willpower to confront meaningful and difficult issues, and it's got to just get some backbone.
We had a state legislator on the show recently, and he I don't mean to pick on anybody, but he said, he would come up with an idea, and then Shelley would say, "Well, let's not rush through on this. Let's look at this a little more carefully. And he said that's what stopped pretty much everything. New York has been called one of the most dysfunctional states in the union, maybe beaten out only by California.
Well, it's interesting. Look, I certainly share the frustration, and as the record reflected when I was governor, had pushed the legislature hard in many areas. In California, folks would say Sacramento is the most dysfunctional. In Massachusetts, people point to Boston. In New Jersey, point to Trenton. So I think it speaks to, and frankly, now we're all beginning to point to Washington and say, is our Congress that dysfunctional? Maybe it is a structural issue that legislative bodies, by their very nature, are designed to be hesitant to change. And when we are at a point in our society where the fundamental changes we need are jarring, it's very hard for legislators to embrace them.
There are also people who argue that the country has become more politically polarized than it ever was in the past. And as President Obama complained yesterday, it doesn't matter whether he even proposes something that the Republicans originally came up with, they're going to vote against.
That's right. I mean, the sense that the Republican Party will say no regardless of what he says.
And earlier the Democrats accused of the same sort of thing.
Which is why I think the frustration is bubbling over in the public. And it is not even an intellectual disagreement. It is merely a visceral reflex that leads to the inability to get things done.
It's my sense you're a political animal. Is it driving you crazy to watch all these things from the sideline?
Oh, look, it's I loved politics while I was in it. I loved the sense that I could contribute. It is something I'm trying to get out of my bloodstream, I suppose, but sitting and watching it is energizing every day.
Just one more thing. In a New Yorker profile from 2007, Nick Palmgarten quotes you as saying about being governor, "My job is to invest the way Alexander Hamilton did, make sure that the rules are enforced the way Theodore Roosevelt did, and make sure everyone has a chance to play by those rules," which is what Al Smith stood for. Very lofty names to shoot for.
Right.
So,
well, you know, it's odd, but those were the three. In my view, they captured critical moments of ideological transformation. Hamilton, Teddy Roosevelt, and of course FDR as well, and then Al Smith, and not sequentially. They really are the embodiment of our ideological framework.
We did have a few other great governors in the state.
Oh, yes.
FDR, Herbert Lehman.
There have been eras where New York state politics defined the grandeur and the forward-thinking qualities of our democracy. And let's hope those days reoccur.
Well, we are a state in which there are many qualified people. It's amazing that we've had such difficulties over the years. My great thanks to Eliot Spitzer, the former Attorney General and Governor of New York State, for stopping by to talk about the current state of affairs, financial and otherwise. It's always a pleasure to talk with
you. Thank you.